You're listening to You're a Financial Planner, Now What? The podcast to help you fast track your career by bringing you meaningful conversations on topics that influence new financial planners, their careers, and the lives of their clients. I'm your host, Hannah Moore, a CFP, firm owner, and practicing financial planner. We are so excited about our partnership with the FPA, and today we're joining with them to host their monthly Journal in the Round. We have four authors from the September Journal of Financial Planning talking more about their articles and their thoughts on each other's articles. It's really good stuff. But before we get to the episode, we have officially launched the FPA Activate Ignite the Passion Facebook group. If you listen to this podcast, this Facebook group is for you. In fact, we designed it with you in mind. Not only is this going to be a community of financial planners who get it, but we're going to actually show you what it is that when we say we do financial planning through our How We Do What We Do series. I'm so excited and want to personally invite you to join us. You can find the link in the show notes at financialplannerpodcast.com or by going to Facebook and searching for FPA Activate. As I said a minute ago, we are hosting the FPA's Journal in the Round. So welcome to this episode and join the FPA series Journal in the Round, where each month the contributors to the Journal of Financial Planning, along with other experts, join this lively roundtable to illuminate and bring to life the ideas and issues on the pages of the journal. The panelists for today's program, The Journal in the Round, The Next Generation of Planners, Shifting the Paradigm, are journal contributors Yusuf Abugaderi and Russell Kroger, who co-wrote the cover story, Serving Millennial Clients with a Three-Step Model, and Lisa Kirkenbauer and Andrew Maihari, who wrote the article, Choosing a Career Path, It's Not Always Client-Facing. Both are in the September issue. So to give you an introduction, Russell Kroger is a CFP and enrolled agent and founder of the Paradigm Wealth Architects, holds a bachelor's in finance from Virginia Tech, and is pursuing a master's degree in financial planning and taxation at Golden Gate University. He's a graduate of Yeski Bui's residency program and the FPA residency program, and was a 2016 NextGen co-director for FPA of San Francisco. He now serves as director of advocacy for San Francisco as a representative of FPA of California, as well as a NextGen representative for the One FPA Advisory Group. Yusuf Abugaderi, CFP, is a senior financial planner at Yeski Bui. He holds a bachelor's in finance from Virginia Tech and a master's degree in economics from George Mason University. He served as director of public relations of FPA of the National Capital Area. He is a graduate of the FPA residency program and in 2016 was named to the Investment News 40 Under 40 list and Wealth Management's list of top CFP holders under the age of 36. Lisa Kirkenbauer, CFP, RLP, Registered Life Planner, and Certified Financial Transitionist, has been president of Omega Wealth Management in Arlington, Virginia for the last 18 years. As part of her curiosity about relationship and communication skills, she is also a certified Colby consultant and author of The 5 Essential Skills of an Exceptional Planner. She is a member of the Strategic Coach Community, and Omega implements the Entrepreneur Operating System, or EOS, to run its business. Andrew Maihari is an operations analyst at Omega Wealth Management. He has been in the profession for 2 years. In 2014, he graduated from Virginia Tech's Pamphlin School of Business, where he completed the financial planning program track. So we'll jump right in. We're going to start off with Yusuf and Russell on their article of Serving Millennial Clients with a Three-Step Model. So the first question for both of y'all is, what caused you to want to write this article? Like, why was this important for you?
So Yusuf and I actually presented on the article at FPA Far West Roundup in Santa Cruz in early August and made the comment that we wrote the article in an effort to bring real financial planning to people like us. That does mean millennials, but it also means those outside of the wealthiest 10%. In a conversation with Dick Wagner, he challenged that the financial planning profession shouldn't or wouldn't be able to become a profession until more than the top 10% were served. And he said, can you imagine if doctors only served the wealthiest of us? And that challenge is very personal to Yusuf and I because we both grew up without much money. And honestly, the primary reason is that there are a lot of ways to serve young professionals and do so profitably. We hope that we're encouraging people with some of our ideas so they can go out and work with communities that are important to them. I think one of the most poisonous comments I hear from our profession is that serving a particular demographic isn't, quote, profitable. Because what that really tells people is that they are unfit or are not deserving of our profession's time or help that the skill sets that our skill sets provide. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've talked to a young professional and they would say, oh, well, we don't have much money to invest. And once I get that, I'll work with an advisor. And no, that's actually the exact opposite. You should feel the right to work with someone before you have money to invest to make sure you get money and keep that money.
Well, I think that's really interesting, this idea that like the words that our profession is using to talk about this issue is actually hurting the general public and really hurting our profession if we're really going to mature into this greater profession that we all want.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that Russell and I spoke about during our presentation was the fact that part of the problem here is millennials and other folks and other demographics just don't view themselves as ideal clients and don't know how to get help otherwise. And so the way that we designed our framework, we made it effective in that it's a three-step model that addresses all six steps of the financial planning process, but it's also efficient and creates a space for the client to connect with the advisor when there are changing circumstances in their lives to determine, you know, what the next best step is without having to redo their entire financial plan. So being able to serve folks who need help without having to reconstruct their plan from scratch every time something changes.
Well, what I really liked about your article is that you guys are really challenging like what it is a financial plan. I mean, you're still using that six step framework, but what is the actual deliverables that are available? So you guys have kind of hit on this already, but what like are millennials looking for this service? Like, is this a need that already exists?
Absolutely. With the millennials that we've brought on as clients this year, it's been our experience that they've done their research. They're looking for financial planners. They're comparing the different service offerings that are out there. And so they're absolutely looking for it. Yesky Bui started providing financial planning for millennials kind of as an organic way to develop business and strengthen relationships with our existing clients. Just looking to build relationships with our existing clients' children, and the service model kind of developed from there for us.
That's interesting because your article is largely neutral on business models. Can you walk through examples of what this would look like practically and profitably, like get into the specifics of it, like hours of the lead advisor that they would actually spend with the clients? Are clients doing a lot of the work on their own or advisors are doing it?
Certainly. So as far as the lead advisor, you know, in my experience in working with several of these clients, I'm supported by one of our financial planning residents with any millennial client that I work with. So I don't do much work other than show up for the meetings and then maybe add a line or two, you know, to the follow-up emails afterwards. Aside from that, all the analysis, all the work is done by a junior advisor or someone who's working in support of myself. We've tracked how many hours of our time, we being the financial planners, that it requires to put together one of these financial plans. And it's less than 15 combined man hours between the two of us. Reason being is we insist that the clients send us all of the pertinent information that we need before we move on with the plan. So we'll have the initial meeting, we'll do the discovery, and then we won't prepare the financial plan until we have all of the information that we need to do so. And so that's one of the ways that we try to keep the time commitment as far as creation of the plan down. So I don't know if that answers part or all of your question, Hannah.
Yeah. So for those 15 hours, how much is the client paying out of pocket for these services?
As it stands right now, we're billing clients on an assets under management engagement. For a client who is building their assets up from zero, obviously that's going to be a very small fee. And we're using that fee structure in this initial year of the formal launch of our millennial program. And we've framed with all of our clients up front that we're very likely going to be renegotiating the fee in year two, once we have a kind of a larger sample of folks that we're working with and can really kind of look at the nuts and bolts of what the service offering requires from us. But right now we're doing it as an assets under management structure, and our wealthier clients are effectively subsidizing the program.
And so you've been very upfront with clients telling them this.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So like the wealthy clients as well as the new clients.
Well, that's just kind of an understanding with respect to, you know, within the business, how, you know, financial planning firms work. It's always the wealthier clients that are subsidizing the service offering that's given to, you know, less wealthy clients if you're using an assets under management fee structure.
And we'll get to that in just a little bit. Russell, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I actually do the traditional XY planning network approach where I have an annual fee that's...
Wait, can I just say, we just said traditional method that the XY planning network uses. I think that's a pretty incredible comment just right there of how far our profession has come.
Yeah, no, exactly. In a short number of years. So definitely.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to make that point because I think that's amazing.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree because it would have seemed strange, I think, maybe a number of years ago for me to say this. But I charge a fee, an annual fee that's broken out on a monthly or quarterly basis, whichever is most digestible by the clients. And I have a minimum fee that I charge, and it goes up from there based on complexity or, you know, the number of times that a client wants to or needs to meet. So, I mean, it basically is dependent upon what the client needs from me. There are other models out there that I really like. Jude Boudreau has an interesting one. I think it's 1% of income and then 25 basis points on net worth that I thought about using. And I might end up switching to that at some point. But right now I just have the basic fee and then the price goes up from there.
Well, I love this idea of testing these models out and seeing what works and being really, Yusuf, like you said, just very upfront with the clients of like, you know, this is going to change. It's likely to change. We don't have to have it all figured out right away.
Yeah, and we found that that's very attractive with millennial clients. They're hyper aware of all of the different options that are out there, and they very much value transparency and communication above all else.
So one of the lines from your article, you say that for a millennial at the beginning of their financial journey, rebuilding their entire financial plan with each change is not an effective use of time for the planner or for the client. So this leads into the need to build financial planning policies with clients. And so when an advisor adopts your framework, like what are the actual deliverables given to the client? Or perhaps a better way of asking that is like, what does a financial plan like tangibly look like?
The deliverable for me has generally been more illustrations than it has numbers. The idea is that if discovery is done well enough, people are anchored to what's important to them. So as long as the policies are explicit in what goals or values they support, the illustrations do a good enough job of helping people evaluate trade-offs and then measure their progress once they've decided on a path forward.
Yeah, and just to add on to Russell's response, you know, for Yeski Bui, when we're working with a millennial client, we always prepare, you know, a tax projection and a cash flow projection. And what that gives us an idea of is what the client's free cash flow or, you know, available surplus is at the end of each month. And once we've identified that number, then we start quote unquote bucketing, right? And so identifying different vehicles they can use for saving for different goals and working from there. But it's all about identifying their free cash flow. And then we're able to build from that.
Are you guys tracking their cash flow on your end? Or how do you know that the numbers that you're getting are accurate?
So we always, everything that we present to the client in that first initial financial planning meeting is a draft plan. And we always confirm that they can sign off on any of the analysis or numbers that we're showing them. And then the way that we encourage kind of the continuation and actual, you know, behavioral aspect of the financial plan is we set up an automatic savings into the account that we manage. And so whether or not the spending numbers are 100% accurate is irrelevant. As long as they're not racking up debt and the monthly or weekly or quarterly deposit to their account is occurring, then the cash flow analysis is reflecting an accurate depiction of their financial situation.
And just to add on to that, I know Carl Richards advocates for a one-page financial plan, and some people may think that's a little ridiculous, but that's actually the simplicity that policies provide. You don't need a lot of numbers. Obviously, they're working in the background, but you know, once people know where their money is and why it's there, simple statements and rules about, you know, what they've put in place serving as guardrails seems to be effective.
Cash flow seems to be this driver for much of these policies that you guys have outlined and what we're talking about. So what is, and Yusuf, you've talked about this a little bit, but what is your approach towards cash flow and your work with clients, like specifically with those clients who don't have the skill set to manage their cash flow on an ongoing basis? Are you having to actually teach cash flow or budgeting skills to clients? Or are you just getting clients who are already kind of have that skill set?
Well, it's mostly clients who already have that skill set. I mean, a lot of the folks who come to us know they need financial planning and are sophisticated enough to be able to make that assessment themselves. And oftentimes what we've experienced is they're professionals who are familiar with either budgeting or some type of cash-based analysis for work. And so they already have those skills in hand, and we haven't had to teach them much. We focus more on exploring ways that they find to be most effective to organize their cash flow, or, you know, be more organized about their money in general. And then from there, we build the structure up after we're all on the same page.
Russell, how about you? How do you approach cash flow?
Yeah, so I'm generally pretty upfront with clients in saying that I think budgets are a terrible idea. They drain a lot of time and mental energy. As is the case with basically all policies, there are calculations running in the background that support the reasoning for the policy. For example, you need to know how to do the time value of money calculations to figure out how much needs to be saved for a specific goal. But cash flow is more about building habits than it is about goals. Since budgets are backward looking, we can pull out themes of spending and then have a conversation with the client around what that looks like relative to what they said was important in the discovery meeting. And when there are discrepancies, we can talk about how to establish policies to help allocate resources towards things that are actually fulfilling to the client.
On the final step, you guys outline the importance of building confidence through collaboration. And you say at each check-in meeting, the planner must vigilantly look for signs that progress is sputtering. So in your experience, like what are examples of this, especially considering just how fast life changes for millennials and job changes and life changes? How do you assess that? Or do you have examples of that?
I don't know that there's going to be a empirically substantiated response, Hannah, but I'll just speak from experience both in my own life and from the standpoint of observing in other millennials' lives. The more transitions, the more likely you're going to have progress sputter, right? So for example, I'll speak for myself. My wife and I are expecting our first child here in about 3 months. We just moved recently. My role at work is changing, et cetera, and she's got a lot going on with her as well. You're so exhausted at the end of the day, just processing all the learning, all the new information, trying to assess what behaviors are going to continue into your new normal, which behaviors are going to kind of stay left behind in your old life. When you get to the end of the day, you have no energy to think about money or saving or the future or what have you. You're just trying to get to bed so you can turn around and then be productive the next day. And we've observed the same kind of thing with our clients. And that's why it's so critical to have these regular check-ins and say, what's changed since the last time we talked? How is that supporting or inhibiting your progress? And then going from there.
Yeah, and I'd just like to, you know, go off of what Yusuf was just saying. The reason check-ins are so important is because goals become outdated very quickly when the landscape is shifting, as it is for young professionals. So if the strength of an anchor, to a particular policy decreases as a goal becomes outdated, people can get distracted by other things and not tend to that policy. And check-ins give the planner the opportunity to ask whether or not goals need to be changed, policy should be tweaked, or if someone was just losing track because of everything going on in their lives. And check-ins also reveal changes in a client's life that may lead to proactive planning opportunities, which can then add value to the client relationship.
And so how often are you guys doing these check-ins?
I'll speak from my standpoint. It's really a function of the client's needs. We're available whenever there's something to be discussed. We insist on at least one meeting per year. But the millennial clients that we've brought on this year, for example, we've had about three two or three meetings when I think about the various clients, you know, in the fold there. And it's just because, you know, they got a raise and so cash flow changed, or, oh, you know, so-and-so is actually considering a job change. How would that affect, you know, their savings plan and that type of thing? So it's a function of need.
Yeah, and I would just echo that. I have, you know, roughly 6 months of running my own firm and having my own clients under my belt. So I can't speak to that as much, but extrapolating, it's, you know, more or less what the client needs. I generally tell them that we're going to meet more than you want to, but less than I want to.
Oh, that's great. Excellent. Well, thank you guys, and great work on getting this article written and published. I think it's great for our profession, and hopefully more advisors will consider working with millennials in this way. Okay, so next we have Lisa and Andrew. And Lisa, you wrote that choosing a career path is not always client-facing. And what I think is so interesting is that you guys paired it with Andrew, your article on choosing the analytical role a young professional's experience. So Lisa, starting with you, like, what caused you to write this article? Like, why was this important to you?
All along in my career development, I've really believed that you need to have somebody who is good at the client service slash operations role, not somebody who's just passing through. And what I'm seeing and hearing in some of the financial planning programs is that people are only, and I love that we've got financial planning programs now, that they're only being groomed to be advisors. And because I'm a student of people, I'm very much into assessments. I'm sort of an assessment junkie. I'm very interested in understanding how people are different and what their different skills and strengths are. And it's not a one size fits all that everybody was meant to be an advisor. So this is something I've been passionate about, I've been talking about. And with Andrew in place at our firm for the last couple of years, it just felt like it was time to really put this down on paper and get that message out there and start to open up a new dialogue about what the career paths are in the financial planning profession.
And Lisa, can you give the listeners a better idea of your firm, like the size, employees, kind of your structure?
Yeah, so we have five people. I'm the senior advisor. I have two associate financial advisors. One is a millennial. The other one is a baby boomer who's a career changer. We have an office manager, and then Andrew Mahari is our operations analyst.
Oh.
And we work. We have about 85 clients. We are managing almost 100 million under management. We take a financial life planning approach, and we have a retainer slash smaller AUM business model.
Okay, great. So just in your experience, and especially this importance of this operations role, so looking at the life cycle of these financial planning businesses, that many of them are starting out as like the solo advisor or entrepreneur, and then they're hiring an assistant. In your opinion, like, what hire should the operations role be?
Well, I actually think that they're probably the next person that you should hire, because if you're trying to be client facing, you know, as the sole advisor planner, the sooner that you can get out of the operations role, the more effective you can be in going and finding more business, meeting with clients. If you're spending all your time trading, dealing with performance, dealing with getting money out to clients, all that kind of stuff that tends to fall in the operations area, you don't have time to keep growing the business. So I think when you realize that you need to expand, you know, is that 25 million, is that 50 million, whatever that number is, if it's in assets or revenue, the operations role really should be the next role, in my opinion.
Well, and that seems so much aligned with this idea that we need to be a business of financial planning, not just there's a business side and then there's the craft side.
Amen. Right. And so you have to start to run a business. I mean, that's the whole e-myth idea, is that you come into financial planning, you want to do financial planning, but you're a business owner. And at some point you have to start to work on the business, not just in the business. And having somebody who can handle the operation side of your business is critical.
You know, one of the things that was in, it was either your article or Andrew's article, where you talked about like the career steps for operations. So it's, you know, with these smaller firms, it's how do you build out that career path where somebody would want to stay with you for a long time?
Well, to be fair, really, Andrew did the work on this. I had created a career path for a financial planning associate. So that's the entry advisor level role, which then leads to associate advisor, lead advisor, and then senior advisor, which is me. And I had said to Andrew, look, I don't have a career path, but here's what we've done for the financial planning associate role. Can you recreate that? And bless his soul, he took that and shifted it to operations. He can talk more about that. But just to give credit where credit's due, I got the inspiration for creating what we have created as the steps, you know, what are the qualifications and what do you need to do to move to the next level from a talk that Rebecca Pomering gave at our local Financial Planning Association meeting or luncheon a couple of years ago.
So Andrew, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So like what, as you know, working within a smaller firm and kind of building out that career path, is it just additional responsibilities and compensation that's tied to that? Or kind of how do you view that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixture of all those things. I mean, I came in here and, you know, I was doing kind of the general ops responsibilities. And I wanted to progress within the firm once I was offered a full-time position. And I wanted to know, okay, what does this progression really look like? And yeah, Lisa had told me that, look, we don't have an ops career path, but here's the advisor career path for you to look at so you can kind of get an idea and that sort of thing. So I kind of used the advisor career path as a stepping stone. And outside of that, you know, I talked to some other firms. I looked back at my internship at another firm. I talked to some colleagues, you know, looked at some Schwab firm surveys, you know, just kind of gathering that sort of data. What does compensation look like after a few years? What does compensation look like after 5 or 7 years? You know, what kind of certifications do ops people typically try to obtain? What kind of roles or what kind of responsibilities come with the role as you move on from one position to the next? So kind of taking that all into account while using the advisor career path as kind of a reference point or a stepping stone, that's kind of how I came up with the ops career path. And after presenting it to Lisa, you know, she really liked it. And after, I guess, a few edits, you know, it became the ops career path for our firm, at least for the foreseeable future.
And so you, I mean, Andrew, so you feel like you have a career path now within this smaller, I mean, 5-employee firm now.
Right. Before I didn't really have a career path and I didn't really know what I needed to do to get to the next level. I didn't really know exactly what my compensation would look like after being promoted, that kind of thing. So that the career path kind of helped solidify that and kind of, you know, made me more confident and made me feel more secure about moving forward.
And so in your career path that you've lined out, I mean, there are compensation benchmarks tied to that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, relatively. I mean, I can't remember if they're actually written down number for number, but I think Lisa kind of has a system where there's relative points kind of tied to the advisor career path in the same kind of way.
So Lisa, how does the compensation differ or does it from an operations role to an advisor role?
So at our firm right now, everybody's on salary. I have certainly used like Angie Herber's approach to having bonuses. And again, one of the things, because I'm very much into how people are built and what motivates them, we found after a while that having a bonus was not really motivating anybody. It was really just turning into salary. And so we went to full salary for everybody who's currently with us. And one of the things that I'm going to have to revisit is as we get to the lead advisor role and there's perhaps, you know, business, new clients being brought in, that's, I think, when we're going to have to reassess things. In the meantime, I'm not treating the operations versus advisor role or career path any different from a compensation standpoint. The operations role is critical to the firm. As I talk about it in the article, this is increasingly an area of liability. You know, the whole first party, third party wires and having to verify them. And if we accidentally allow money to go out to somebody it shouldn't have gone out to, we're completely liable for that. And so this is a really important role and it shouldn't be compensated any less than the people who are sitting face to face with a client, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I think, and again, I think that goes back to this, if we view it like a business, you know, there, what are the roles and how do they all fit together as the greater whole?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody has an important contribution to make.
So Lisa, has this helped with higher employee retention rate? I know the operations career path is a new thing, but you've had an advisor career path for a while. Has it helped with retention?
You know, I really think it has, because it's created, and this is important, I think, for most younger planners, and even for the operations side. You want to have a sense of where you're going, and that's why a lot of young associates leave, is there's either no clear career path, or it's not followed, or it's arbitrary and capricious. And so people seem to be clear on what they're supposed to do. They're focused on it as we meet quarterly and annually. They're looking at what are the steps I need to take. They're checking them off with me. So it feels like it's working better for everybody, not just for me or for them. It's a win-win for the entire firm.
You know, in the article, you highlight the need and the value of the Colby assessment in hiring. And I know you love the assessments. So do you do this for all positions, right?
We do this with every client, and anybody who's going to be hired into our firm does a number of different assessments. So Colby, StrengthsFinder, Myers-Briggs, which was really valuable to understand about Andrew as well. And sometimes we use Emergenetics as well. And so it's very, very important for us to understand how you're built, what your strengths are, and then to try to put you in the right role that fits with your strengths.
Okay. So Lisa, can you talk more about how the Colby has helped enhance your firm and how the employees relate to each other?
So we find that having this understanding of each of our own strengths, then understanding each other's strengths, and then being strategic about the roles, the projects that people take on, we work as a much more effective team, a more efficient team. We avoid some of the emotional, affective sort of stuff that happens when people are different than you are. I'm very different than pretty much everybody else in the firm. And if we didn't understand that about each other, we would have a lot more conflict. And certainly before I started using these kind of assessments, that easily could happen. You think you make affective judgments, like people are being lazy, or they're not doing this, or they're not doing it well, or they don't care, all affective judgments, rather than understanding that somebody is built differently and you need to respect that difference and you need to figure out how to work with those differences and strengths. And it's certainly true across the different roles of advisor versus operations.
So from your perspective, Andrew, as an employee in a firm that uses a lot of the Colby assessments and using that to kind of hire people as well as shape the firm, what has been your perspective on the value of these assessments?
I think they're great because really they helped me, specifically the Colby, I would say, helped me kind of, I guess, know more about my strengths and how I work methodically, and what benefits me the most in how I work. And when I got to the firm, kind of what I had in mind was doing some of that, the analytical operations and non-client facing work that I had enjoyed in my previous internship. And when I took the Colby and got my results back, that I was, you know, very process oriented, very detail oriented. I followed through on work that I would submit and deliverables and that kind of thing. That just spoke to me and, you know, confirmed what I already thought about, I guess, my work habits, and helped, I guess, provide some proof that I really do think this role is for me. And if I'm successful with it, you know, I think the Colby helps solidify that.
And, you know, Andrew, in your article, I thought what was so great is that you hit on this concept about identifying and being aware of like what you're naturally drawn to. We make the assumption that everybody wants to be an advisor, and that's just not true.
Right.
Were you exposed to the idea that there were other career paths, like when you were in your degree program?
Not really, honestly, not really. And, you know, maybe that's part of the reason of that is because, you know, the profession is still new, or I guess newer than most other professions that have been around. And right now, maybe it's just that because of that newness, the advisor role is kind of the default role, or the role that's talked about the most, you know, because it's kind of directly associated with the CFP nowadays, at least with all the commercials you see on TV now. But yeah, no, in my program, I didn't really know or think about too much what I would be doing outside of school besides working in a financial planning firm and probably being an advisor. That's not 100% what I wanted to do, but that was kind of where my head was at because, you know, this is what they kept telling us in school. So it wasn't until I actually went out into the profession and actually got some experience with some firms that I realized, okay, then, you know, there's more than just the client-facing role. There's a, you know, there's all these other roles that I can, you know, depending on what firm you end up working for and how many positions they have open for that role, you know, I don't have to be doing this, or I could be doing this a different way, or, you know, there's an art to it. Maybe you can combine different responsibilities from each role and create something different for yourself if your employer allows it. So it was more so me understanding that there's more to the planning profession than just a, you know, client-facing advising once I had graduated and done some internships, honestly.
What has helped you in your transition from college student to being a successful professional? Really specifically, like, what has your firm been able to do to help provide or help make that transition smooth?
Well, just first from transitioning from, you know, being a college student to working full time, I think at least for me, the biggest benefit that, or the things that helped me the most were, number one, you know, keeping my finances in order. You know, we're lucky to come from the financial planning program. So a lot of these strategies, whether it comes to, you know, budgeting or cash flow or, you know, learning to pay off debt, learning to manage your credit, that kind of thing we learned in our early planning courses is really applicable to professional life, especially right after graduation, where you probably don't have the best credit score if you're taking out student debt. So in that aspect, I used a lot from what I learned in school to, you know, build a budget, you know, learn how to pay off my bills, learn to manage my credit, you know, more thoroughly and that sort of thing. But aside from that, like working with Omega, it's just been a great in terms of like the environment here is really supportive. You know, I work with another millennial, Jared, who is an associate advisor here. And yeah, I mean, it's just been really great because I actually came in when we were in the middle of a transition from one custodian to another for the majority of our client accounts. And I was kind of, that was my immediate role when I had come in. And yeah, I mean, since then, there's been a lot of growth for me. Lisa's extremely easy to work with and she's open to new ideas. And she was really open with the career path, you know, strategy that we came up with. And whether or not I want to get my hands in different roles or different projects has been really easy to do as well. So kind of the openness, the firm environment, I would say the firm culture and, you know, kind of, you know, learning to manage your money once you start working really helps me. So
y'all have been listening to each other for talking about these articles. So I'm curious, Lisa and Andrew, so it's fair to say that a lot of larger firms are now kind of looking at how to profitably serve millennials as they're becoming a greater percentage of the population. From an established firm's perspective, like how plausible do you see that three-step framework that Russell and Yusuf outlined in creating and integrating a service model targeting millennials?
Yeah, Hannah, I mean, this is something that we have been talking about for probably 2 or 3 years as part of our strategic planning and have a fairly clear sense of what we're doing. And we're also starting to sort of beta it a little bit. So similar sort of three steps, but a little different focus because we're very much into assessments and we found that to be really valuable in sharing with young people, you know, just starting out in their careers, understanding their strengths, figuring out what's the best path for them to take. That's part of the beginning of our first step. So our discovery process is similar, but different. We also, because we're very much into the life planning side of things, Our goal is to use like the Kinder 3 questions. So to really start to give people, these young folks, something to focus on and be intentional about how they live their lives. And for us, we see it as being part of an offering to the children of our adult client. I mean, the adult children of our clients. And so that's a little bit different, perhaps, than going out and trying to reach other people. You know, just have a separate offering or something. So this would be, we call it Omega Financial Planning. I think I've got a new name for it, which I'm not going to share right now, but I have a new idea for it. The second step for us is more around, like Russell was talking about, habits, not goals. It's a little early to have big goals, especially before you're married or buy a house or anything like that. It's our focus is on building good habits. So, you know, introducing them to apps and strategies that help them build good financial habits. So things like cash flow, we're interested in cash flow, but we're looking at it in a way of like introduce them to mint.com or to YNAB or, you know, one of the budgeting apps that's out there and get them tracking their expenses from the beginning, setting up auto investment, whether it's into, you know, some sort of investment offering or whether it's just savings or whether it's into their 401k at work, and then credit score monitoring. As it turns out, that's like a really hot issue now, but really building that basic skill, because credit score is so important to employment, insurance, getting an apartment, getting any money for a car or, you know, a place to live in. So we think that getting all of that, those pieces together early and easily, and starting to develop that relationship, like they talk about in the, you know, really the third step, we see ourselves as a thinking partner and as an accountability partner. So a thinking partner is they go through various questions, and rather than asking their parents, they're asking us. As an accountability partner, hey, we're wondering if you've thought about doing this. Hey, did you get that set up? And so we see it a little differently, but I think fairly similarly. And as far as the actual sort of business model, we see it as a loss leader too. The idea is that these are the inheritors eventually, that we like understanding the whole family system. And so if we can understand the dynamics between parents and kids and grandparents in some cases, that we can be more helpful advisors. The model itself we envision is a sort of onboarding fee, sort of a one-time onboarding fee to do the assessments and life planning and everything, maybe paid by the parents, and then having some sort of monthly subscription fee, no assets under management fee, because that's not really appropriate. And then eventually they might graduate into our regular three-tiered offerings, if that made sense, you know, as they grow. So I think we have sort of similar ideas, and we're pretty close to, we're like I said, we're practicing with different pieces of it. We just haven't pulled the trigger on, you know, having an agreement for it and actually having, you know, kicking off the monthly subscription piece.
And so one of the things that they had said, or Yusuf had said, that there were total about 15 hours of work from the lead advisor or support staff that were involved with each client in the course of a year. Does that seem reasonable to you?
You know, I think it depends on what you're doing. That's part of what we're trying to walk through right now is we can envision, and we're stealing this from other people, is that over a 12-month period, there may be months where they're just listening to a webinar. So it's more educational, and maybe a couple, three times a year, probably two, that we would be checking in again for that accountability, goal setting, that kind of thing, you know, like annual goal type of stuff, not long-term goals. And then, as Yusuf mentioned, and I think Russell mentioned as well, that it's more on an as-needed basis. So trying to have some things, offerings, but as technology leveraged as possible, that's the only way I can see this working to start, is that it's got to be pretty highly leveraged.
So Russell and Yusuf, as you're listening to this, kind of what are your thoughts on what Lisa's outlining?
I'll speak first. I'm just excited to hear that there are other firms that have been thinking about this for some time and see some validity to the ideas that we're proposing. I mean, our whole thrust was just to continue a conversation that we thought was happening, but that needed to be happening on a broader level. And so it's exciting to see that other firms are going to be diving in.
One of the comments Lisa made was that this is really going to be like a loss leader for their firm. And I think a lot of firms are going to take that mentality. But you guys are proposing maybe that it doesn't have to be that loss leader. Is that just going to be just come down to business models, or kind of what are your thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, I think it really is going to depend on the business model. And, you know, just because it starts as a loss leader doesn't necessarily mean that it will continue to be one. You know, part of the deal with millennials is that they're at the early part of their career. And if you snag them now, the idea is that they'll continue to accumulate assets, and the relationship, aside from being fulfilling with respect to the client planner engagement, will also end up being profitable in the long run.
Hannah, to be clear, I mean, when I say loss leader, we're making an investment in the future.
Yeah.
We know that it gives our main clients peace of mind to know that their children, their adult children, are getting good financial advice and are getting set up well. And we're really okay with that. I mean, we're not trying to make money. I think we might break even, you know, if we do it right. It's taking a long view, you know, a multi-generation view to our business. And honestly, just from a very smart standpoint, we don't want these assets to leave. If we don't start building these relationships, the assets will leave. And so, I mean, part of it is for us a life planning piece that we really want to engage the next generation, and we're excited about that. And part of it is honestly just smart business management.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what I like about what you're saying, Lisa, is that your ideal client is still going to stay the same. This is just kind of a add-on service, if you would, almost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just picking up the, I mean, it just makes sense when we think ahead on the demographics, and to go back to, as Yusuf and Russell were talking about, you go back to Dick Wagner's book, and he's like, everybody starts this way. Now, the reality is that we can't let go of the clients who brought us to the dance, but it's time to pick up the next generation along the way so that our younger advisors can be excited about the business and aren't always just dealing with people who are literally 30, 40, and 50 years older than them.
Andrew, do you have any thoughts on this, especially from an operational standpoint?
No, I mean, I really liked Yusuf's and Russell's article. I think they brought up really good points with the millennials want to be seen and heard and want to feel valued, and the fact that we live in a space now where everything is digital and, you know, there's no limit to how expressive you want to be online and, you know, there's no limit to kind of finding your niche and what you're into. And I think that planners in our in the profession can definitely attest to those values or those niches, especially with, you know, all the kind of stuff that's happening around socially responsible investments and, low cost ETF index funds and that kind of thing to kind of supplement those millennial wants and needs. And I also really liked the part about the financial policies. I think they called them compact decision rules. I think for millennials especially, these like periodic policies make a lot more sense for them than the, you know, like overarching kind of long-range financial planning recommendations that are more suited for wealthier, more traditional, older clients.
So Russell and Yusuf, you've been listening to Lisa and Andrew's kind of portion. And as young planners yourself, what thoughts do you have around the need for young planners to kind of be aware and identify what they're not naturally drawn to, especially as it relates, you know, to their career?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, you know, they're attracted to financial planning because they like working with people, they like helping people, and maybe they're good at numbers, right? And, you know, I went to Virginia Tech, which is one of the top programs, you know, in the country preparing people to sit for the CFP exam. But one of the things that I think even great education programs don't do a very good job of is helping people identify what their roles are going to look like. And so when you graduate, everybody's looking for a job. They're not necessarily looking for a job that's going to be, you know, a long-term thing, trying to make partner track. Obviously, for a lot of people, that's the idea. But if you don't have much experience, even internships really don't, you know, maybe do as much as we would like, but you don't have a sense of what's out there and, you know, who you want to be in the profession, and you get that through experience. And I think that, you know, having some flexibility and autonomy to figure that out is really important. That's one of the reasons why I joined, or actually probably the main reason why I joined Yeski Bui's residency program back in 2015, was because I wanted the opportunity to experience different aspects of the financial planning profession. And I worked for 18 months before that and, you know, was kind of getting pigeonholed into a certain thing that the firm wanted me to do. And that wasn't necessarily authentic to me. And that was kind of frustrating. So, you know, doing this residency program gave me the opportunity to explore different areas. And then once I figured out what I wanted and I graduated from the program, I was able to start my own company because I knew what I had wanted.
And I'll add on, just from a different angle. I think one of the critical things that a young advisor needs to do, as they're considering what kind of a firm or which firm they want to join, you'd better have your own personal investment philosophy ironed out. You know, it's not one of those things that you can just, okay, well, we disagree on a couple of things here and there, but overall, this is going to be fine. You really need to know what your deal breakers are and then be able to match up with a firm that has the same approach. Because obviously investments, are not the only part of the financial planning engagement. In fact, it's, you know, just one of, you know, five or six realms that we delve into pretty heavily, but it is the fuel that kind of thrusts the financial plan forward, if you will. And if you're not clear on that and don't see eye to eye on that with the firm that you're joining or that you're at, it's going to lead to some problems.
And from an employee perspective or from a new planner's perspective, how important is having that career path laid out at a firm? Speaking to like the people who are actually going to be hiring these new planners.
Yeah, it's my opinion that having a clear, structured, nuanced career path is one of, if not the most important thing that you can have as a firm when you're looking to recruit new talent. Because if you can't tell a young person where they can expect to be or where they should be, if they're performing well, you know, in a year, in 3 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, then, I mean, at some point it's going to become, there's going to be time wasted and there's going to be frustration, because expectations won't be aligned and, that'll lead to issues.
And so, you know, looking at the idea of employee retention, I mean, losing an employee is just incredibly costly. Yusuf, from your perspective, I mean, do you have a career path laid out in front of you?
Yes. Yes. All the way from entry-level planner to what someone would have to do to become a partner or a managing advisor at the firm.
So your loyalty to your firm is going to increase dramatically because you have that laid out.
Absolutely. Because I know that, you know, if I do A, B, and C, that's going to lead to the role and the career and the function, you know, that I'm aiming for, that I'm dreaming about as a young planner. And, you know, speaking from experience, having that career ladder is what got me through some of, you know, maybe a frustrating period or a difficult period where I couldn't, you know, I wasn't quite doing exactly what I wanted to be doing. But knowing that if I just continued to chip away at it, eventually I would end up where I wanted to be.
And you're able to see proof of this from your firm as well. I mean, it's measurable. You know, if they're lying to you or if it's real.
Right. And that's the thing about, you know, having that agreement. The career ladder effectively serves as, you know, a contract of sorts between the firm and the employee. And as the employee moves up the ladder, if they see that the response from the firm is in line with that, then it's another signal of trust that continues to build as the relationship grows.
Well, as we wrap up, are there any other thoughts that any of the four of you guys have about these articles or this conversation?
Well, Hannah, I just really appreciate the opportunity for us to be in this dialogue. Over the years, I've been a little frustrated that across generations, we're not having open dialogue about where planning is going for the profession in the future and what the career paths look like. And I'm very excited about what Yusuf and his firm are doing, and excited for Russell. There's lots of different opportunities, and hopefully that's what's going to have come out of this whole podcast, is that there are different paths. There's a lot of exciting opportunities if you're coming into the profession right now.
Great. Well, thank you all for being here. We appreciate it and hope everybody enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for hosting.
Thank you for joining us on this special episode of You're a Financial Planner, Now What? And the Journal on the Round. Remember to join the FPA Activate Facebook community and connect with other planners who are just as passionate as you. Next week, we're sharing a special interview with Dave Yeske, the 2017 PCAMP Fain Jr. Award winner. It's an episode that you won't want to miss. We'll talk with you again next week.